We are gathered here today to mourn the loss of the year 2000, or Y2K to some of its closer acquaintances. Y2K unfortunately endured a rough period, but has now passed on peacefully to a better place. Let us not remember the aftermath of Y2K. Instead, let us remember a time before our anxieties, before our responsibilities. Join me, leave the future behind, and go into the light of the screen. Welcome to Y2K, the podcast where your host, Amanda Ladino, escapes her existence and subsequent existential crisis into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. This week, we're discussing Roman Holiday, the 1953 romantic comedy that presents us with life's eternal lessons of responsibility, duty, setting boundaries, and only ever, ever going home with strange men whilst under the influence. If that strange man happens to be Gregory Peck, Princess Anne of unnamed nation that is definitely not England is traveling Europe for a goodwill tour. And her confining schedule and duties cause her to go from a princess to queen. She wants to break free. One night, after being given a sedative to calm down, this is the 1950s, shout out to all the Xanax babies, Anne escapes into the city of Rome to Rome, of course. What could go wrong on an evening in Roma? Well, Anne's sedatives finally kick in and she falls asleep when Joe, a burnt-out reporter, finds her. Joe tries to bring her back to her home so she's not arrested for public intoxication, but with Anne only stating the Colosseum as her primary residence and the cab driver's unwillingness to drive around with Anne until she sobers up and tells him her address, Joe allows Anne to sleep on his couch. Joe oversleeps and misses his scheduled interview with Princess Anne. Don't you just love when adorable coincidences are written beforehand? Joe goes to cook up a story to tell his boss, even though apparently he can't cook breakfast since he takes half of the secretary's breakfast. And Joe's boss chews him up and spits him out like his secretary's breakfast and informs him that he could not have been at the interview because the princess came down with an illness and canceled the press conference. Once Joe sees a picture of Princess Anne, he immediately recognizes her as a lightweight from last night. Joe makes a deal with his boss that he can get an exclusive interview with the princess. And Joe goes home and Anne wakes up, startled and confused. But once she's assured that she didn't lose anything last night, wink, wink, she gets ready to walk amongst the commoners. Joe casually happens to bump into her three more times, and they agree to have a Roman holiday and do all the things that she wants to do. And after unsuccessfully trying to mug a Girl Scout for a camera, Joe's photographer friend Irving joins the mix. And the two men are off to fiddle while Anne's on a Vespa about to burn some rubber in Rome. After near collisions, a false maiming, and a brawl on a boat, Anne is ready to return to her duties. Well, almost ready. Her mind is determined, but her heart has wandered into Joe's palm. And soon, both Joe and Anne are embraced in each other's arms and in some really intense kisses. But they must part. But not until Joe and Irving and Princess Anne finally attend the press conference. Joe and Irving, through code, ensure Anne that they will not reveal the true story or the pictures because they love her. In different ways, but it's still love. Luckily, all the dumbass press agents who can't read between lines despite that literally being part of their job leave the press conference and Joe stays behind, hoping that Anne will come running out. And eventually, Joe turns around and slowly walks away, still hoping that Anne will run to him, but knowing that she won't. We are now entering our fax machine portion of the pod, where we discuss interesting facts about the movie. Roman Holiday was released August 27, 1953. The film had a budget of $1.5 million and brought in $12 million at the box office. The film was shot entirely in Italy. Paramount wanted it shot in Hollywood, but the director, William Wyler, declined and insisted it be shot in Italy. Because of this, the budget was cut, resulting in the film being black and white, not Technicolor, and in casting an unknown actress, Audrey Hepburn. This was Audrey Hepburn's American film debut. She had done European films before, and mostly plays. At the time of filming, Princess Margaret of England was having a relationship with the regular schmo Joe, and the concern that association would be made with Margaret was so high that Paramount filmed an extra scene to ensure that Princess Anne could not be mistaken as being a British princess. Dalton Trumbo was a screenplay writer. Trumbo was one of the writers that was blacklisted in Hollywood. While Wyler was against the blacklisting in Hollywood, he still needed someone to front as the screenplay writer of the film for Trumbo. Ian McKellen Hunter fronted for Trumbo and was credited as a screenplay writer despite not contributing to any of the writing. Ironically, shortly after this, Hunter himself would also be blacklisted. Hunter gave a portion of the money he got for quote-unquote writing the film to Trumbo, and Hunter also accepted the Oscar for Best Screenwriting. In 1993, Trumbo's widow, Trumbo died in 1976, was given a second Oscar. Hunter's son would not give away his dad's Oscar, so they created a new one to give to Trumbo's widow. And in 2002, and every version since, the story credits have been changed to correctly credit Trumbo. Trumbo was not the only one to receive an Oscar from Roman Holiday. It was nominated for 10 Oscars and won 3. For Best Screenplay, Best Costume Design, I mean, obviously, Aegis Head did the costume design, Best Actress. Peck predicted that Hepburn would win an Oscar for her performance and lobbied with the producers for co-billing on the movie. The director was William Wyler. William Wyler was known for being a perfectionist and doing an incredibly high number of retakes. He was called an actor's director. He was a nice man, but ultimately terrible to work with because he would do so many takes and provide no clarification of what he wanted from his actors other than, according to the advice that he gave the Laurence Olivier, to be better. However, at the end, he always managed to bring out the best performances from his actors and they would always win awards. He started the careers of Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday and Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl, and many of the lead actors in his films received Academy Awards such as Hepburn, Olivier, Betty Davis, Charlton Heston, and more. Wyler immigrated from Germany in 1921 to work at Universal Studios, which was owned by his cousin. Wyler volunteered as a major in the Air Forces during World War II and made documentaries of the war in dangerous conditions that included flying over bombing stations. In one instance, Wyler passed out from a lack of oxygen, and in a separate instance, was so close to a B-52 when it exploded that he was left permanently deaf in one ear. Gregory Peck did not serve in World War II due to a back injury that occurred during his acting training. During World War II, Audrey Hepburn famously helped raise funds for the Dutch underground by performing dance recitals. Hepburn had been a ballerina for 4 years prior to World War II at the Arnhem City Theater. These dance recitals were performed at the Resistance's Black Evenings, where the windows would be blackened out or darkened so that the Germans didn't know what was going on behind them. Hepburn had also helped in giving food and messages of where to go to British airmen who had been shot down because she spoke fluent English. Hepburn's famously small frame was a result of the malnutrition she experienced during the war. She almost died from starvation and survived at one point on nettles and tulip bulbs. Hepburn went on to become a UNICEF ambassador from the years 1988 to 1992, and she unfortunately passed away in 1993 due to cancer. Hepburn's diplomatic character, strength, and love gleamed through her performance as Princess Anne in Roman Holiday and stayed with her throughout her career and life in the public's eye. Roman Holiday also introduced and solidified Hepburn's ability to have chemistry with an older leading man love interest, which remained the case in almost all of her films. Hepburn always seemed to remain the Peter Pan gamine, full of energy, curiosity, and spirit throughout her career, and her co-stars were always somewhat grounded and drifting along until they were finally brought back to life and its meaning from the playful, mischievous essence of Hepburn as she pirouetted by. Humphrey Bogart was 55 in Sabrina, Fred Astaire was 58 in Funny Face, and Cary Grant was 59 in Charade. Cary Grant actually turned down the role played by Peck in Roman Holiday because of the age difference. He was uncomfortable with the age difference in Charade as well, but ultimately let it slide because in the movie, Hepburn's character chases him in that film, so he didn't feel it was too creepy or silly looking. Despite Peck's character in Roman Holiday going against the type he had been cornered into playing as the man of principle doing everything to fight for what's right, you know, Atticus Finch, the whole lot. In Roman Holiday, Peck perfectly encapsulates a rugged damsel drudging along in silent distress, who's forgotten what's important to him, who's all of a sudden saved and revitalized from meeting and falling in love with someone who's experiencing life in pure joy for the first time. Roman Holiday went on to influence an insane amount of movies, many of which are DCOMs, Disney Channel original movies, and Hallmark movies. I mean, My Date with the President's Daughter took this premise and really ran with it. The two films that I think of as obviously being influenced by Roman Holiday are the Before trilogy. The movies use the concept of two strangers aimlessly wandering around a city doing fun activities and talking. And Notting Hill, obviously the biggest callback in Notting Hill to Roman Holiday is the big press scene in the end, but the two movies have different endings. In Roman Holiday, you have the bittersweet ending where Princess Anne and Joe talk in code to express their love to each other. And then once the press conference ends, Anne returns to her duties as princess, and Joe slowly walks out of the scene. Both the audience and Joe, even though they know it's not going to happen, keep wishing with each loud, deafening step that Anne is going to run out and be with him. And in Notting Hill, you get the happy ending where Will runs to the press conference that Anna Scott's having, wonder where they got that first name from, and Will and Anna talk in code to express their love to each other, and they end up together. Let's roam into our most excellent portion of the pod and discuss my favorite things about the movie. First and foremost, the costume designed by the ever elegant Edith Head is astounding. The first ball gown that Princess Anne wears, the off-the-shoulder sweetheart neckline with the sash across the torso with the poof skirt, is stunning and very clearly influenced Demi Lovato's coronation dress in Princess Protection Program, another DCOM classic. And while not as showy, Anne's outfit that we see in the majority of the film, the button-down shirt and skirt, is a classic look that just looks fun but put together. And the best part, the skirt has pockets. That's all a girl has ever asked for. The costume is also used for storytelling in the movie. In the first scene, Anne removes her heel and is unable to retrieve it. And this may be digging in too deep, kind of like Anne's heels, but feet, hear me out, feet are a way to escape, and they are being constricted by her heels, which are meant to diminish a person's speed to escape and are made with appearance in mind. Maybe that's too much, but anyway, Anne removes her heels and fails to retrieve it by the time she's told to sit down, but she's able to subtly signal to her staff that her shoe is in front of her, she needs to put it back on, and she seamlessly stands up, covers the shoe with her gown, places it back on her foot, all whilst pretending to do this to prepare to dance, and then goes on to dance just on the whim. She's just like, yeah, I can do a ballroom dance right now, whatever, I'm trained in this. And this scene automatically shows the audience that Anne's playful. She doesn't like the control that her position is demanding, but she's also able to use her mind quickly. In this scene, we also see that the movie is starting to set up foreshadowing that will soon show Anne's growth later in the movie. During the scene at the ball, Anne initially goes to sit down, but is tapped on the elbow by her staff to signal that she must greet her attendees first. In the last scene, the press conference scene, Anne's staff taps her on the elbow to sit down, but she chooses instead to go against her staff and greet her attendees instead. In the scene after the ball, Anne is wearing a light nightgown, standing on top of her bed, saying what she wants in life to her assistant. And when she returns to her duty, ready to be princess, she's wearing a dark robe, standing on the ground, telling her staff the new boundaries that she is placing with them. The movie doesn't just use its foreshadowing for plot, they also consistently weave in callback jokes. To call back, get it? To a previous point of mine, when Anne is in her light nightgown, she says that she wants to wear pajamas, and more specifically, just a pajama top. How scandalous. The next morning, she wakes up in Joe's bed and realizes that she's wearing his pajamas. And she goes frantically to check under the covers to see if she's only wearing a pajama top, which is then set up for a double entendre. And Joe asks Anne if she's, quote unquote, lost anything. Get it? Get it? One of the main callback jokes is the locations of Joe's money, which I did not appreciate when I was a child, but I think is hilarious now. When Joe finds Anne's asleep, she rests her head on his chest. So he moves the money away from his chest pocket to his left hand pocket. And when paying the cab, Joe checks the original pocket that he had his money in, and he realizes that it's not there, and he quickly looks over at Anne and remembers that he changed the pocket. And then later, the next day, when he wakes up, he checks his pocket again for his money. I just find that so funny, because like, he thinks this is the longest possible running con, and that she's just like this amazing top tier actress, which Audrey Hepburn is, and so is Princess Anne. But it's all a ruse to get that $3 that he has left in his pocket. The other big callback slapstick joke is Joe spilling everything on Irving to warn Irving not to spill everything, as in that they know that Princess Anne, that Anne is Princess Anne. There's also a lot of double entendres and subtle dialogue-based jokes like this throughout the movie. Like when Anne is getting undressed and Joe goes to leave while she changes, and Anne tells him he may withdraw, and her skirt falls to reveal her slip as she says this. At another point, further along in the story, Joe tells Anne that he sells fertilizer because he's bullshitting her, and Anne says at midnight she'll turn into a pumpkin, which is ironic and sad because Anne is already a princess, so it's the opposite of Cinderella. Her fairy tale is just to be an ordinary person. And later in the movie, Irving leaves because he has a big quote-unquote development, as in film development, to do. And obviously, as previously mentioned, there's the recurring slapstick joke about Irving spilling everything, and the movie has a bunch of this physical comedy in it, too. When Joe goes to open his door that night when Anne's falling asleep, Anne is falling asleep onto Joe's back, and then Joe realizes this because he's like, what is this extra weight on my back? And backs up slowly to get her to get off of his back so that he can open the door. And then Joe leads Anne up the stairs, Instead, she's so tired, she doesn't go up the stairs. She goes around the staircase. And finally, we're building up to the biggest slapstick scene in the movie, the Secret Service fight scene. It's amazing. It's groundbreaking. My favorite bit is when Anne pushes the agent in the water and throws him a lifesaver. And I think that's really great because it doesn't just work as a joke. It works as a way to show Anne's character. And there's little bits like that throughout the whole movie. Like, Anne always takes her gloves off to shake people's hands. And she takes the smallest, quiet bite of a saltine cracker in the history of the world. And her idea of fun is genuine fun. You know, just childlike things like eating gelato and shooting straw wrappers and riding a scooter, because she never got to be a child and do these things. And none of these little character quirks are shouted at the audience. But what is shouted at the audience is the band that is playing while the fight scene is going on. And Anne takes one of their guitars and hits a man over the head with it. And then this man is dragged out by the police by the handle of the guitar over his head. But the film still uses this dance fight scene for more than comedy. You start to see that things are changing between Joe and Anne. Joe starts looking at Anne lovingly and starts to show some guilt when he's lying to her. But him and Irving are still writing down the barber's name for the story and taking pictures of her dancing with a barber and fighting the Secret Service. But then they go back to Joe's place, and the excitement of the fight scene drops when they're reminiscing on their wonderful day. And the news cuts in about Princess Anne being sick and how anxious the people of her country are. And Anne turns off the radio, and everyone knows that she's going back. And now we enter our goodbye scenes. So there's two goodbye scenes. The first goodbye has lovely, heartbreaking acting. Joe and Anne are both unable to look at each other because they know they're going to break down if they look each other in the eye. But then they decide to break anyway because it would be worse if they never looked at each other. Anne tells Joe not to watch her leave. Which is fair, you know, I would do that too, because you don't want to hurt your loved ones by having them see you leave them for the last time. But Joe decides to watch her leave anyway, and stays there watching, hoping that she'll return. And second bye, even more soul-crushing. The next day, the second goodbye is at the press conference, and Audrey Hepburn shows a million emotions in 2 seconds. When Anne sees Joe at the press conference, and she goes from shocked to afraid to concerned, all while trying to remain calm and composed. And you get the balance of bitter and sweet that we've been seeing throughout the whole film. When Irving takes a picture of her with his lighter as a joke to reveal that he was taking pictures of her the entire time they were on the Roman holiday with his lighter. And then Irving gives all the photos that he took to Anne. And with this, the movie places importance on both romantic and platonic love, because both Joe and Irving get their bittersweet goodbye with Anne, and you see the emotion and love in each goodbye. And then you cut to Joe, and there's a moment of silence that seems like it'll last forever, before he announces himself and his press and speaks in code to Anne to ensure her that he has no story to report about Anne. And with each press question, the camera keeps cutting to Joe, and you see him slowly getting more and more choked up while trying to remain composed. Anne ends the press conference on remarking on the city that she enjoyed visiting the most. And she pauses, looking at Joe. Her assistant whispers what to say. Anne begins to go into a political speech about how every city in Europe was beautiful in its own way, and stops herself and says Rome was her favorite city to express her love to Joe and Code. And then she and Joe smile and nod goodbye to each other, like in the final scene of La La Land. And all the reporters leave the press conference, and Joe stays behind waiting, and slowly walks away, and then stops and turns around to look back for her, and to decide whether or not he wants to go back to get her, and then turns back around and slowly walks away. This is just such a lovely, beautiful, cozy, romantic, and heartbreaking movie. And so much credit has to be given to the actors. Audrey Hepburn wonderfully encapsulates the viewer's attention with her energy and way of holding herself in a kind, diplomatic nature, and Peck immediately swoons the audience. Liza Minnelli once perfectly described Gregory Peck as the ultimate movie star, saying, "There's nobody more handsome or more gentle or more romantic on the screen." And Roman Holiday is a testament to that. Moving on to the more unfortunate segment in the pod, the most bogus portion where I discuss my least favorite things about the movie. The movie can feel a bit long in certain areas. I feel like the press pass scene in the police station dragged on a bit. And Audrey Hepburn, while being phenomenal in this movie, was a little bit over the top when acting in the breakdown scene. In all fairness, at this time, Hepburn did do mostly stage acting, which requires more over-the-top acting because you're on stage, your audience is a significant distance away, so you really have to be louder, be more expressive. A little inconsistency that I noticed was that Anne wears a bow tie when they go dancing at night. That's different from her usual bow tie that she wore during the day. So when did she get this bow tie? Was it Joe's bow tie? Did she buy this bow tie for like a commemorative reason? What's the story? And this isn't a critique of the movie at all, but doesn't life just suck that in 1953, Anne gets sandals, a haircut, and gelato for $1.50? Joe could have really used some of that money to buy a camera instead of trying to take one from a kid. I think that scene was like supposed to be funny, but ultimately it just came off like kind of cringy to me. I felt like they could have cut it, just had Joe meet Irving at the cafe right away and convince him to take the pictures of the day. During the first goodbye scene, which again is wonderfully acted, Anne starts crying face down onto Joe's tweed coat. And all I could think was, if you get a single fiber in your eye, it is game over. This is no longer emotional crying. This is fear. This is anger. This is, you're going to start sneezing. It's going to be a whole mess. On to the big uncomfy stuff. This movie seems to like getting extremely close to non-consensual dangerous territory, but at the very last minute, veering away. Like, when Joe takes Anne under the influence to his home, they really build up that this is the only option. Because Joe just wants to get Anne home and not be asleep on the street, because she'll get arrested for public intoxication. So he just wants her address to drop her off at her home, but she won't give him a straight answer. So Joe pays the cab driver to let Anne stay in the cab until she sobers up and can tell him an address, but the cab driver refuses to let Anne stay in the cab, and then he threatens to call the police, and Joe doesn't want her to get arrested, so he has to bring her to his apartment. And then again, we enter more concerning territory when Anne asks Joe to help her undress. But luckily, Joe only will remove her bow tie and leaves while she changes. And then when he comes back and sees that Anne is sleeping on his bed, he moves her from his bed without touching her, just with his covers flipping her, onto his extremely small couch, and they sleep separately. Ultimately, the worst thing in the entire film is when Joe shakes and lightly slaps, but still very much slaps, Anne to get her to sober up and tell him her address. On to a more comforting note, we are entering the peaceful portal portion of the pod where I discuss what about this movie is comforting to me. This was one of the first black and white movies I ever watched, and it is a wonderful movie for people who want to start watching black and white movies. Get a pencil and pad for this, along with I Love Lucy for short comedies to get used to black and white and have fun, The Awful Truth for a screwball comedy, The Zen Man to be sipped into a mystery, Roman Holiday perfectly rounds out the black and white movie starter package. It's got everything. It's got comedy, it's got romance, it's got heartbreak, it's got a gorgeous cast who can act extremely well, all under a rich, velvety black and white cover I just want to curl up in. For all that, combined for the price of just $3.99, you too can get lost in a wonderful story that would soon be bastardized by the mouse and greeting cards conglomerate. Thanks for listening. And thank you for joining me in escaping my existence into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. I hope you'll join me in our next episode on Kiki's Delivery Service. This podcast is released every other Tuesday on all listening platforms. If you like the episode, please rate and review our podcast on your listening platform of choice. Apple Podcasts is preferred, but any support is appreciated. Or you can tell a friend or a loved one, or even a stranger that you think would like the show to give it a listen. Any and all support is appreciated. If you want to keep updated on the pod between releases, or just let us know what about the film is comforting to you, you can catch us on Instagram at @Y2000Pod, or on Letterboxd at Y2KPod. Thanks for listening to Y2K. We love you something fierce. And thank you to Yusu Kim for our totally rad theme song, and to Bonnie Cohen for our gnarly-ass podcast art.